Light is all around us. From the morning's first rays of sun to the waning glow of a crescent moon. From the torches of our ancestors to the glowing screens of our mobile devices, light is our guide, our timekeeper, and our guardian. Light shows us where to go and how to move. It teaches us how the world works and how to react. It helps us comprehend our reality. It lets us see. And there's nowhere where this is more apparent than when you're at a concert, listening to your favorite band, and the lighting designer is firing on all cylinders.
I'm your host, Luke Stratton. Join me each episode as I sit down with different lighting designers, directors, and programmers from the live music industry. We'll dig deep to find out what makes them tick, what tools they use to get the job done, and what it means to be a mad scientist, a wizard, and sometimes even a Jedi. You're listening to The Light Side. Welcome to episode 3 of The Light Side. My guest this episode is Paul Hoffman. Paul is the lighting designer and director for the American rock band Widespread Panic. He's been involved in numerous projects involving the members of the Grateful Dead, including The Dead, Further, and Fare Thee Well. He's also the co-founder and owner of Pulse Lighting. Pulse has provided equipment and services for John Legend, Grace Potter, Mountain Jam, Ultra Music Festival, the Tony Awards, the announcer's booth at the Super Bowl, as well as various installations around the country. Paul, let's start at the beginning. What's your first memory of manipulating light?
Oh, goodness. It started early, for sure.
I'd say earlier than most.
Yeah, probably. 6, 7, 8 years of age, something like that. I'm sure we always used to have fun with Christmas lights and stuff like that. But I think what really probably got me into it the first was we went on summer vacation with my parents up to Massachusetts, a beach up there when I was 8. And there was a rock club on the beach. And two things happened to me there. One, I think that's really when I got into rock and roll lighting and started to really get, you know, jazzed by it.
Yeah.
And I also got into drumming.
Oh, okay.
And decided at that point that I wanted to be a drummer as well. So both things hit me at the same time.
And I'll say drummers make excellent light guys. You know?
Well, we try. I hope so. That's really where it started. And it didn't stop. I was, you know, quickly stealing my dad's landscape lights and putting on quasi-rock shows, including drumming, of course, in my bedroom.
So doing your own light shows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then moved from my bedroom to the backyard. It got bigger. And just did a lot of that as a kid. And I got shipped off to England at the age of 11. And there was a lot of plays, you know, theatrical work going on there. So I got involved in doing lights for plays.
At the age of 11?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Running conventional light boards and just conventional lights with gels and nothing fancy. But I did that for years in England and I had a great time with it.
So what happened next?
Well, came back from the U.S., from the U.K. in 1990 for college. Went to Georgetown in Washington, D.C. and continued with the theater thing there. Pretty quickly got into it and kept going with theatrical lighting. Still nothing automated or intelligent at all, just, you know, dimmers and fixtures. And then it took kind of a left turn and left lighting behind for maybe close to 15 years. Mm-hmm. Became an IT consultant and went deep into that world.
We actually have that in common. I used to do software for hardware stores.
You know? Yeah, it's the same kind of mind, I guess.
Yeah.
And started a company doing that and had that company for 14, 15 years. And then it came back, you know, like a like a bug. It came back and got me. And I think, you know, it was really starting to go see a lot of the jam bands that were happening in the late 90s. Definitely was at, you know, Fish a bunch of times and other bands, Mo and other ones that were impressive. And I was just like, I've got to do this. I've got to get back into this. This is way more interesting than what it was like in the theater, and I've got to do it, and I can't sit in an office under fluorescent lights anymore. I just can't. So I made a life change, largely with the help of a business associate that I had that actually knew Candace Brightman personally, not because of lighting, but just because of familial ties, actually. He was her brother-in-law. And he very kindly introduced me to her one time, and I think I just bugged her.
Yeah.
Enough after that. She was working with an iteration of The Dead called The Other Ones at the time. And we stayed in touch. We talked about lights. She probably, you know, she had a really enthusiastic young kid on her hands trying to contact her all the time.
And so
she,
how old were you around this time period?
This is like 03, 02, 03, somewhere like that. So that would put me around 30, or, you know, early 30s. And eventually we just started doing some work together. Candace Brightman and Andrew Gumper, who worked with her as a programmer and also a provider, between the two of them, I just got involved and got involved quickly and was a pretty quick study on things, I hope. And eventually sort of kind of went with Candace wherever she went from that point on.
And, and that would be, right to widespread? Like what happened after Other Ones?
Right. Well, after Other Ones, they had The Dead for a while.
Sure.
And so I was out with her in the summer of 2004 on that tour, programming and crew chiefing.
And this, as this MA1?
This would be MA1, okay. And then the Dead kind of packed up shop for a while, and the next phone call that came was for Widespread Panic in the spring of 06. And I confess, I didn't know much about them. I mean, I knew I'd heard the name, but I didn't know.
But you were familiar with the like scene, if you will.
I knew the genre they were in.
Sure.
Yeah, but I didn't know anything about the band. I couldn't have told you a band member's name or anything, or a song, really. Yeah. And went out with her, you know, for the whole time that she was on that. Really, I think she retired in the spring of 08, and I went away for a little while as well, and then came back in early 09 as the LD.
When she was there, would you say you're programming and crew chiefing as well for Widespread?
Yeah.
What does that look like from like a relationship between the two of you? Are you like no creative design input and she's just telling you what to program, or is it more of a collaborative?
Oh, no, no. She loves input.
Okay, great.
She pushes you for input, which is great. Didn't always have that much input to give to the great master, but we would talk about things. You know, I'd come up with ideas, and some she liked, some she didn't, as would be expected. But she's extremely open to collaborative work and other people's ideas, and encourages it, actually.
Walk us through your design process with Panic, everything from the initial sketching up to showtime.
Definitely in the beginning, my trusses always kind of looked like something, as opposed to just a functional straight truss up there that had lights on it. And a lot of that inspiration comes from architecture for me. I walk around all the time and look at buildings. I'm big into it. I don't know much about architecture, you know, class trained or anything, but I do enjoy looking at it a lot. I really like Art Deco, and I, you know, big buildings, especially from the 20s and the 30s. I'm always inspired by that, so I'm always looking for shapes, you know, relationships of shapes, curves, straight lines, and all that type of thing. And I start with a very elementary program, not a CAD program, and I've changed what it is over the years, but it's very elementary. Just allows
a Microsoft Paint kind
could of program. Could be, yeah. Sure. Just allows you to move shapes around and get rough ideas together of how the lines move and how it would look. And then, of course, you got to think about how the fixtures are going to work on it as well. Yeah. And then gradually, you know, I'm not a skilled draftsman by any means, but I work with one who's able to bring it into a more formal, you know, CAD drawing.
In modern day, is that Vectorworks?
Or AutoCAD, yeah. I work in Vectorworks. The guy I like to work with works in AutoCAD, so we're able to trade files.
Back and forth,
I'm giving him ideas, and he's coming back with formal plots.
Yeah, technical drawings.
Yeah, and it evolves a little bit in that process.
Yeah.
You know, you realize that you really can't fit all these things in here in real life. Mm-hmm. You can in a concept, but so that, you know, it evolves as well from that. And, you know, when you get into the rigging, it evolves a little bit more. When you get into the electrics of it, it evolves a little bit more. And so it's very iterative. Until one day you see it built. And that's always a...
So what? What's the over-under on, man, you're impressed when it goes up, or, oh, man, I wish I had hung it totally different?
I did accidentally create a uterus one time for Widespread Panic. It was 09 or 10 or something like that.
Yeah.
And somebody noticed it on a piece of paper on my desk about 2 days before I left for tour, and I hadn't noticed it.
Oh, man.
And I thought to myself, well, that's all right. Maybe no one will notice it.
Yeah.
5 minutes after it was up, the stage manager was like, I wonder what Paul was thinking about when he was designing this. We rolled with it for half a year anyway. I mean, it turned into a pretty good rig, but...
Was it known amongst you and the crew as the uterus rig?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and beyond.
Yeah. Well, on the flip side, do you have any, like, favorites over the years?
Yeah, the double circle was hit me really hard.
Yeah. Is that your Mark Brickman influence coming in?
I'm sure a little bit, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure. Actually, you know, it's going to sound particularly stupid, but the final inspiration for that came from a hot dog stand here in Raleigh, North Carolina.
Really?
Their logo.
Yeah.
It was like a big double circle coming up out of a hot dog, which is preposterous. I kind of changed it into a sunrise. It's like a sunrise that's not all the way up.
Sure.
Or has just started to go down. So you're not seeing the bottom of the circle.
Okay.
It looks like it's been cut and sitting on the stage. And then... you know, a double with lateral lines in between it. Once I started getting it into the software and working with it, it was a really cool looking shape.
We just did our first like Circle Truss show. We did like a Floyd tribute.
Yeah.
And, you know, you spend a lot of time on a normal like flat rig making all these specific positions, but on a circle rig, you just point them in the circle.
Everything
in the center
looks gorgeous.
And turn it. 1 degree is one, another degree, like every degree is another great look.
Absolutely.
It's really, really fun.
And you get an interesting effect going with the tiniest bit of manipulation.
Sure.
It makes wild stuff happen. It's a really interesting shape to work with.
Now, do you battle with, on these kinds of rigs, with the unique hanging of fixtures, having problems making your effects move like you want them to? Like,
oh, yeah.
Can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, yeah. When you hang lights physically in anything other than a straight line... it's very hard to get anything straight out of it. So in other words, I'd give you an example. If you wanted to have a perfect tilt effect of all the fixtures going up and down parallel to each other, you're going to have a hard time getting that out of a curve.
Yeah.
And it's beyond my capability to do with effects, so I do it, you know, the old school way with cues, and I'll have a top position and a bottom position and just have it, you know, run through that
between
way.
Between the two.
Right, which is actually how I do most of my movements. But... yeah, it's difficult, especially when you get into compound curves. I think in 2011 we had curves going two different directions at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's a treat, too, to focus every day.
Oh, man, I can only imagine.
Yeah, because, your movement of a trackball or of encoders, there's some muscle memory to it.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, you get used to being able to move something to a specific position, and when every light behaves differently, it takes a while.
So from a programming or like a day-to-day operations, are you guys building a like home position where things are straight?
Yeah.
And then you use that to rebuild other positions?
Yeah, I have a lot of different utility positions that will never actually appear in a show.
Mm-hmm.
But they are they're used as building blocks to get to other positions.
Of course, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe let's talk about your relationship with Widespread Panic, the band. Are they, how involved are they in the creative process? Like, what kind of input do you get both before a tour and night to night?
Very little from the band themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've gotten to a place now where they really trust me a lot, and they always have, I guess, because they've never had a lot. To say about it creatively, plus or minus. There's a few things that they don't like. And when we added video to the show, I definitely got some more remarks because...
When was that?
That was 2013.
Okay.
First time we had video. And that's really the first thing that they can see on the stage.
Sure.
You know, it's a weird industry that the people that write our paychecks are the only people that can't see what we do. And so... when we added the video, you know, they definitely started to get some more interaction from them, which is cool. I always value it.
Yeah.
And JB himself is a photographer in addition to other things, and he
so great visual eye.
He likes to give me. Now he actually gives me photographs to work with.
Oh, nice. Yeah, nice. Well, you mean as content?
Yes, content.
Oh, that's great.
Like I guess most people have seen the chicken.
Yeah.
The chicken was taken by that photo was taken by him in Ireland.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it was, it's great to have his direct contribution.
Yeah, it's always nice to have someone. You know, in my project, it's kind of like they don't really have a lot of input, but every now and then they'll be like, "I feel like this song should be green,"
right?
And that's like the only rule for me because I have so few rules.
Yeah.
That I make sure that song is green.
I don't really get much along those lines.
Sure.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite song to light?
In the panic world, I guess you mean.
Yeah, in the panic world.
Yeah, a couple. I like Pilgrims a lot and Wrangler quite a bit. And then I like some of the, what I call like the kind of old Panic epic tunes like Surprise Valley, Driving Song, things like that.
Yeah.
Things that give me a very distinct visual image or an idea of color or what it should look like. So I'd say those are probably my favorites.
Are you in the cue stack world, meaning that you've pre-thought through some or all the songs, or are you totally punt, which would be more of a improvised live performance?
I would say that I'm a hybrid.
Hybrid.
With a majority punt.
Okay.
So I really, at the end of the day, you would say I punt every Panic show all the way through. But I do have little bits of cue stacking that I use strategically at certain times in certain songs that'll do a sequence of things that would be really hard for me to punt through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like something for a specific lyric or a specific...
Yeah, something like that. I do echo some of the lyrics. I try not to do it too much. That can be overdone.
Yeah.
But
an
example, I guess if you wanted to know one, would be the passing lights and Driving.
Uh-huh.
You know, during that lyric, there's two white spots that swing through the audience. And just the sequence of everything to make that happen, I couldn't punt that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I have little tools like that. I have maybe 20 or 30 of them that I pull on to do things.
And are those all like on one specific page on your console?
I try to stick as much to one page as I can. I do page around for a few things. I don't like to do it. I'd like to keep it all on one because I've gotten to the point now where I'm basically running the lights with my right hand.
Okay.
And
what are you doing with your left?
I'm triggering video with the left.
Oh, okay. And that's on a separate console?
It's on a laptop.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
So I actually had that later on, but we'll skip ahead here. So the MA isn't controlling the video at all. They're totally separate systems.
The MA does partially control. Mm-hmm. So I have some intensities and some speeds that feed into... I'm using Resulum now for the first time.
Yeah.
I was using the MA VPU for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I switched to Resulum. It's working better for me because I have more control over it at front of house.
Yeah, they have a lot of tricks.
Yeah.
I've seen some crazy stuff with Resulum done.
So I do have... So the MA does talk to Resulum for things like layer faders.
Yeah, and blacking things out.
Intensity. A couple things will cue a particular video. A couple lighting cues will also have a video clip in them. Not very many. Speeds, clip speed, transition speeds, all that's on the MA. But I'm using the laptop to my left largely for clip selection and a couple other small, things.
So is it kind of like you'll maybe black out the layers and pick with your left hand and bring them back in? Or
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that type of thing. I used to run all my features with my left hand.
Yeah.
And do all the other lighting with my right hand. And
now I'm
a hand short to be able to do that. So I've written a lot of macros that I use for key lighting.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll have, if it's a JoJo and JB vocal, I've got a macro that will pick them out.
Sure.
I've got several that'll almost bring up any combination and then drop them away again, which I still am doing with my right hand as well. So I'm definitely pretty busy.
Yeah. Of course. It's a busy job.
It's a skill that would be 100% useless in any other job.
Yes. This is very true.
Yeah.
So I guess back to the video, where do you guys get your content? I know you said JB gets you some of it, but are you guys using artists or specific designers, or are you coming up with this content yourself?
We when we first started with the video, we just did static content.
Uh-huh.
That's actually going back to the band's input. They were very hesitant at first to have motion video.
Mm-hmm.
They were new to the whole concept of video, so
sure.
It was originally sort of presented as a changeable backdrop, and that's the way we use it. They did not want to have a screensaver behind them.
Yeah.
And I can understand that.
Or the iTunes visualizer.
Right.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. So we started off with a lot of static images, and a lot of that came from some of it came from band photography, and some of it came from off the internet, and it really came from all sorts of sources,
sure.
Independent artists. And then when we got into motion, I'm really now using a lot of the band's proprietary art,
mm-hmm.
because for a lot of reasons. One, it's thematic, it's in theme with the music that's going on. I think the fans enjoy seeing, like, poster art's a great example.
Oh, I have that poster.
Yeah. I was at that show,
yeah.
Or whatever. And I really like that. And I'm using a lot of the capabilities of Resilient to manipulate it. So we're not just showing a picture of that poster, but we're going to put some sort of dynamic effect on top of it, or layer it with another one. So you might see a little bit of a poster, slip by for a second.
It's kind of like what they do. They're teasing one lick here, and
right?
Like, yeah.
And it's almost like mixing the posters together in the way that they mix songs together. And then working in some other purchased video content. Like, I have a lot of space related. I'm a space nut too.
Yeah,
I have a lot of space related content. Yeah. I have a lot of nature. I love the animals.
Yeah.
I love the animals on posters.
Yeah.
They had a turtle for a fall or a couple years ago. They've had raccoons. They've had everything. Using the animals on the posters is great, and kind of mixing it all together. So it really is a mishmash.
So my friend Katie has a question she wants me to ask. She in Broomfield this past Halloween, apparently the house lights just came on during Paranoid. And nothing else. And she wanted to know, was that your design to make everybody paranoid, or was that like a curfew thing?
It came from high up.
From high up.
Yeah. It was intentional.
It was intentional. Yeah. Okay. That's the answer she was looking for.
Yep. And it came from high up in the organization.
Yeah. I wasn't there, so I didn't know exactly what happened, but it sounds like it was a scary moment.
It scared me.
Okay.
It was a great effect, though. That's actually not something I probably would have thought of.
Yeah,
and it worked well. I didn't want it to look like an accident.
Yeah,
and I don't think it did.
Okay.
Yeah, and okay. if you'll notice that we went black after that.
Well, that the thing she said was that the stage lights were off. Which,
right.
But for me, immediately, that's got to be intentional. Like,
right.
If it was like a oops or a
Well, what I didn't want to do was have them come on and then have that be the end of the show and have them stay on.
Yeah.
Because that to me would have looked like an accident.
Yeah, absolutely.
But we went to black again after.
Oh,
that.
Oh, so was it the end of the show?
We went to black and then did a second encore, which
okay,
we haven't done in years.
Yeah.
And we never go to black ever.
Oh, really?
Full black. So. That was, it was clear that that was on purpose.
So is full black, like the band doesn't like that, or you don't like that, or?
They don't like it.
Do you, or does Pulse Lighting have any particular fixtures that are really hot right now that you guys are into that, you're putting in all your installs or sending out on all your tours, or is it more of like a case by case thing?
It is case by case. We've certainly done a lot with, Roby Lighting, in the recent past, a lot of their stuff is really cool. And they also, some people might not know, they have a branch of their company called Anolis, which is architectural lighting, which can be DMX controlled, or it can be, sort of set up with a touchpad controller for mm-hmm. different scenes. And it's really good for lighting rooms, lighting bars, lighting outdoors, facades, parking garages, you name it. So both of those heavily GLP.
Both great companies.
Yeah, great. Love the GLP stuff.
I read this earlier today, but let's talk about the X4S. Do you still use that as the Leco replacement for widespread?
I've changed to the X4.
X4, a little bigger.
Which is purely academic.
Sure.
I mean, what comes out of the front of it is identical. There's just more of it.
Just an extra ring.
And the reason I did that was because there was a couple places where we go outdoors, like... a big shed like Alpharetta.
Yeah, or maybe Red Rocks.
Red Rocks,
yeah.
Or any, that only happens a few times a year,
yeah.
But when it does, I needed more punch than the X4S had.
Yeah,
so
yeah, they're great in like a club or something.
Yeah. So I reduced the quantity and increased the size.
Is it just one per band member?
No, there's two per band member with a couple extras for guests as well. Yeah. So,
yeah, it's a great fixture.
I had a zillion X4Ss up there.
Yeah.
I have less than a zillion X4s.
Yeah.
Yep.
Have you used the Spiky at all?
Not yet. I haven't even seen it in person.
I just had Greg Ellis on, and he loves that fixture.
Yeah.
In fact, I asked him if you could build a rig with one fixture only, what would it be? And he said the Spiky.
Really?
He's doing a lot of the like 360, you know, because it can 360 pan and 360 tilt.
For EDM, yeah, I'm sure that could be. Yeah. A great fixture. People have told me it's going to be a part of my life soon.
Yeah, yeah. It's got that flower effect. It seems pretty cool.
I want to see it. To a certain extent, working, you know, so much of my work has been concentrated on one band for the past decade. And that band doesn't necessarily call for every new bell and whistle. I saw Lasers on your list of, you know, questions, how do I feel about that type of thing. And I love Lasers. I've done a lot of EDM work, and I think they're great in that environment. I don't think Panic is a laser band.
Yeah.
And I don't think that they're necessarily a band that needs the Super Sharpie. Or what's that high end thing with a million heads in it?
The shapeshifter,
or even maybe the BI. I don't know. Yeah.
But the BMFL though is probably a great fixture for them, right?
Yeah, and that's what we're going to have.
Yeah,
more of that.
Just big, rich textures.
Absolutely.
Instead of flash.
Right.
Yeah, I get that.
Wide, powerful.
Yeah.
You know, new and interesting gobos. I lost all my custom gobos when I shifted away from Verilight.
Yeah.
I had spent a long time and a good amount of money building up a gobo arsenal, and then we moved to the Viper, and I kind of lost them all.
Yeah.
And I'm not planning to stick with the Viper, so I haven't started building the repertoire up again. My time coming any day. Don't worry about no. So long I felt this way, I didn't know how to know.
You've kind of become the go-to lighting designer for many of the different projects involving Grateful Dead members. Correct me if this list is wrong, but The Dead, actually The Dead, Further, Dear Jerry tribute, and of course Fare Thee Well last summer.
Right.
So did you grow up listening to The Dead, or was that kind of a later thing after you got the gig?
I grew up in England for the most part, and there was the Grateful Dead, but it certainly, you know, when I was growing up over there, it was more about the Pet Shop Boys and Depeche Mode and U2 than it was about anything coming from this side of the Atlantic. So am I historically a Deadhead? No, I'm not. And I didn't even really, you couldn't even really have said that about me when I started working with Candace.
Mm-hmm.
I've always respected what they've done. And enjoyed it, and certainly enjoyed the visual side of it, but I couldn't call myself a true, like, hardcore fan.
Sure.
Having learned a lot about it as a result of all these experiences, I mean, yeah, it's now got a piece of me that, you know,
of course,
that'll never go away.
Let's talk specifically about Fare Thee Well. For those listeners who may not be familiar, in 2015, the Grateful Dead had a reunion show of sorts. And they had Bruce Hornsby back out on keys and Trey Anastasio from Phish filling in on lead guitar. So, Paul, tell us about your involvement with that. How did it come about? Were you potentially in the running for a lead designer, and then they found Candace in the woods somewhere? Like, give us the background story on that.
Yeah, they had to send out a search party to find her.
So can you tell the story? Is this a real thing? Because Andrew was kind of telling me that there's a search party story.
Candace can be a little elusive.
Sure.
I don't think it's quite a search party situation. She can sometimes not necessarily want to talk and then not want to talk on the phone. But I don't think that was the case here. We all saw the show announced long before anyone ever started talking about the lighting or who was going to do it. And I know that there was a lot of very talented people considered.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a smaller group of that group was then asked to submit a design or a proposal or concepts. And Candace was obviously one. She's a natural choice. She obviously was the LD for the Dead for years. I mean, I think she should have been one of the first ones considered. And I really came along with her.
Sure.
She called me and asked me if I was interested in doing it with her. And of course I was. And we worked together, and we had to compete for it. It wasn't a hand, you know, it wasn't just given to us.
So these are the things that you don't know, you know, from the outside.
Yeah, no, there were other people competing for it, names that you know well.
Yeah.
And, you know, we didn't know. I didn't know what kind of odds to give us. Candace had been out of the game for a little while. I don't think she'd touched a light console for
that was my next question.
Seven or eight years.
Like, does she know MA2 at all?
No, not at all.
So you're an essential part of
that's why I was there.
Yeah. Essential part of that team.
Yeah. That's why I was required. But, you know, it when I heard that we had won the competition, I guess, if you want to call it that, obviously was really excited, and I knew that it was going to be a long road ahead, and it was a long road ahead. And that, you know, there were many, many, many months, and there were many, I call them design cul-de-sacs. Mm-hmm. There are many roads we went down that went nowhere.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we put a lot of time and effort into a certain direction of thinking and then had to just turn around at the end and come back and go down and find the next avenue.
Yeah. Now, when you're having to make these, first the pitch and then these decisions, who was saying yes or no? Was it the band? Was it some form of management agency?
I think everyone had a lot to say about it,
okay,
including the Dead members, the Dead management, also Madison House, and Peter Shapiro,
of course,
and everyone who was involved from that point of view. Most of that was funneled through a single person to us, Robbie Taylor, their longtime production manager,
okay,
and good friend. So he was really the one that we were primarily talking to. But I think in order to get the answers to our questions, he had to reach out to a lot of other types of people to figure out. I mean, there were a lot of things discussed that didn't happen. I mean, at one point there was going to be a massive set built. And that ended up not happening, but it consumed many months of time and effort and, you know, entertaining that idea and developing that idea before ultimately it was scrapped.
So with the design itself, I mean, there's a couple things I just have to remark on. The follow spot operators being on these trusses kind of like above the band was like, I'd never seen anything like that before.
Right.
And, you know, if you're in the first front half of the audience, you can look up and see these guys like inside the light rig.
Right.
And so were they controlling? What fixtures were they moving? And how did that work from a technical perspective?
They were there for – the reason that they were there was for angle.
Mm-hmm.
There was really just no other place that we could find to put them that wouldn't have involved its own separate structure or something else to screw up the field.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's no close balcony.
No. And also there were complications with the grasskeepers on the field.
Yeah, okay.
The people who were responsible for maintaining that field, and that was a whole nother thing.
This is Soldier's Field.
Soldier
Field, yeah.
Yeah. So they had VL-3000s with the pan and tilt physically unplugged from the motherboard.
You just went in there and took them out.
Yeah, not personally, but
because I mean, doesn't the BMFL have a feature now that you can turn that off? I think
Very possibly.
Yeah.
I actually thought the Varilights did as well, but their solution, the Bandit Lights, provided that in Chicago, and Felix Lighting provided it in California.
Yeah, so for those of you who haven't seen pictures of this, you actually have guys in a truss with a normal moving head fixture with like a handle on the back.
Yeah.
And they've unplugged the pan and tilt motors.
Yeah, it was a custom handle.
Yeah, so you guys have control of dimmer, color, gobo, if you use any of that.
Correct.
And then they're just following one guy, or were you calling cues for who to follow?
No, they were pretty much permanently assigned to one guy.
Okay.
Unless a guest walked out, which didn't really happen. I don't remember if it happened at all.
I don't know if it did.
I don't think it did.
I was expecting Donna, but it didn't happen. Not in Chicago, at least.
No. I didn't see her. So, yeah, they were stuck to one guy. Even guys that didn't move very much. Like drummers.
Honestly, we were joking about this earlier. It's like, oh, Phil's taking a step. Okay, no, he's going back.
Yeah. Sounds silly, doesn't it?
But, no, I mean, I get it. It's a big deal.
Right.
I mean, if you haven't seen this rig, there are pictures of this lighting rig online. Is Live Design, I think, did a feature on it.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible, like, I can't even understand the level of engineering that, you know, that maybe you don't even run into with a normal shed gig where they're bringing in all this structure and you've got these crazy big arched trusses.
Right, and massive video walls.
Massive video walls.
I mean, very large, very heavy video walls on the side, which our trusses were hung in front of, kind of like Christmas ornaments.
Yeah.
A little bit.
A little bit.
And we were also outdoors, and so the elements were a big concern. Mm-hmm. We didn't have any rain.
Yeah.
We had a rainbow, but no rain.
A sidebar, can you settle the rumor here? Did you guys manufacture, or did Pete Shapiro manufacture that rainbow somehow?
Oh, you don't want me to ruin the party, do you?
We'll leave it a mystery. How about that?
Yeah, yeah. Look on the internet. It's all there.
Yeah. So I guess talk a little bit about the rig. What did you guys end up using, both as an overall design shape, if you will, and what fixtures were key in making it happen?
Well, the fixtures went through a lot of revision. And we, because of the how close the West Coast and the East Coast shows were, we could not use the same rig in both places. So we had to duplicate it on both coasts.
Yeah.
On that weekend, July 4th weekend, which might be the hardest weekend of the year to get lighting equipment. So we had to find a fixture list that could be duplicated on both sides of the Atlantic on that weekend. And a lot of changes got made for that reason alone. Mm. Which is, you know, not the reason you want to change fixtures,
but
that's what it came down to. Something we were very, very lucky to get 50 BMFLs at each show.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bandit had just purchased theirs. They might have been in cardboard boxes, and Felix had theirs as well. And we were very lucky that those were also brand new fixtures, because servicing them would have been a monstrous task.
Sending a tech up to one of those things, they don't make genie lifts that are 300 feet tall.
Yeah. Right. And then for the next size down of mover, we used Vipers in certain places and Varilights in certain places. Mm-hmm. And that, a lot of that had to do with gobo selection.
Okay.
So anything that was likely to be pointed at a band member or around a band member or was for lighting a band member, including feature light, we used VL.
Yeah.
And then for things that were more aerial, like out on the wings and the audience and that kind of stuff, we had Vipers.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the delay towers, we had Mac 2000 profiles because we were, everyone was out of everything else.
Yeah.
You know? There were no more Vipers. Yeah. There were no more VLs available. So, we were literally down to, who could produce 80 of the same fixture on both sides of the country. Yeah. So, and then...
You had points in there too, right?
There were some points on the show. Mm-hmm. There were VL 3500 washes on the show, and there wasn't a whole lot of LED. I don't remember.
So, what is the from a console perspective? What's the fixture management look like for a rig that big? I mean, did you have a layout view for every section of the rig? 300 different groups? Like, what's that management process like?
I don't think it was 300 groups.
Yeah.
I mean, we kept the programming simpler than it could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that was coming from Candace and she was the operator.
Yeah.
I mean, I did some operating, but it was really her gig.
Sure.
And she likes to keep things simple. She doesn't like massive amounts of complexity. She didn't want to page around.
Yeah.
She wanted everything to stay within a very manageable, control surface space, and she didn't want to have to reach over to the right hand screen. We kind of built it all for her on the left hand, two thirds of a Grandma II full, and then of course she had a big conventional console as well, which was really just the DMX in wing.
Yeah, just playbacks for different features.
That console was chosen because it was one of the only ones that could have three separate scenes.
Okay. What console was it?
It was an ETC.
Just a big conventional.
Big ETC. Yeah. Can't remember the model, but it was instead of, most crossfading consoles will have two scenes. This one actually had the ability to turn the Submaster bank into a third scene.
Okay.
Which is what she wanted to do. So she'd have an entire combination of moving light looks and effects and everything literally going on a scene of that console and then be able to crossfade it.
Okay. So she's kind of coming from a more old school perspective.
Yeah.
But then feeding that into the MA.
Correct.
I like that a lot. That's cool.
And actually, not a lot of people do crossfading off of moving light looks, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's
I don't see it a lot.
Well, the way that you're describing requires a ton of playbacks.
Yeah.
So, and the MA doesn't have that many without adding external devices.
Right,
so.
And that is a huge manual board.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
DTC 4896 or something.
Was it the kind of thing where you guys had done enough work, she just knew where stuff was, or was it all very well labeled? Or did she already have a system that she was
By the time we got to the shows, she knew where it was.
Yeah.
We spent a lot of time moving it around.
Yeah.
And at one point I had to say, Candace, stop moving things. Because you're never going to remember if you don't just freeze them. Freeze them where they are, and then you'll start to know where they are.
Yeah.
By the time, you know, we spent a long time in pre-viz, pre-programming. And
what were you using for the pre-visualizer?
Grandma 3D.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. That was all done at Bandit Lights in Nashville.
They have like a big studio there.
They do have a very nice previous suite, big one.
But you guys didn't, I mean, you didn't build the rig beforehand.
No, we had to, you know, we had one of each light in the room with us, but.
A rig that size though, I mean. Yeah. Do you build the widespread rig before it goes out?
If the schedule allows.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've had the privilege to do it a couple times, and I've had the misfortune not to be able to a couple times.
Yeah. I'm familiar with both.
Yeah.
But building the rig for me is like in someone's basement.
Right. So by the time we got to the shows, she'd been running that rig virtually for more than a few weeks and had definitely gotten the hang of it. And I think, you know, the California shows, I hate to say it, but they were a warm-up for everybody.
Yeah.
A band included.
How could they not be?
That was a ramp-up to Chicago. And by the time that we were into Chicago, she was killing it. I mean, it was like she'd never left.
Yeah. I have to say, you know, I'm both a big Deadhead, but also a big Fish fan. So for me, it was I had to be there, and I don't usually say that kind of thing anymore. I'm a workaholic, so those three nights are the only time I've ever missed a professional Dopapod show.
Yeah,
because I had my ticket request in before we even thought about filling our calendar out. Then we got a High Sierra offer. I have to say though, being there, it was very magical.
Well, I didn't look forward to the conversation with the panic management either.
Oh, yeah. They had shows, right?
They had shows at Red Rocks. Big Red Rocks shows, and then a July 4th weekend in San Antonio.
Yeah.
I wasn't looking forward to that. They were extremely cool about it.
Yeah. And Preston filled in?
Preston took care of those shows.
It's the same DNA, man.
It's the same, yeah.
Yeah.
It's, no difference.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was probably cool for Preston.
Yeah. He never fails to have a fun time.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. I have one other question about this event. I helped Preston out at summer camp with Moet. I did some programming on that BMFL profile, and he said that you guys use it in your file. Is that true? Do you know?
You mean the profile?
The actual profile that controls the light?
I believe we do.
You know, even if it's not true, I'm just going to stick with that I had some small part in that concert.
Does it say BMFL LSD?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, okay. Yes. We do.
Excellent.
Yep, we do.
You heard it here first, folks.
Yes. Luke, you're in everything, like the force.
I'm trying. I'm all around you.
Yep.
All right, let's talk about style. Maybe cut back here to your own operating style when you're running a show. How would you describe it? One way I like to try to get to this answer is if you were sick or couldn't make a gig and someone had to fill in for you, but like the band and the audience couldn't know. Like you had to tell Preston how to run the show.
Well, that did come up.
Yes. Well, so what's the trick to the Paul Hoffman?
I am self-taught on the MA and probably don't do things the right way or even a common way. It's probably its own weird thing.
That's the great thing about the MA.
Luckily, Preston and I learned together, and we showed each other things and did a lot of shows together. So we had a pretty good grip on what the other guy's show looks like because we ran the same show for years, you know, on any band, whatever. We had the same file for years.
Okay, yeah.
So I had him out. Actually, I flew him out to a couple shows earlier that year and made him get up there and do it.
Yeah, okay. So he had to walk right in there.
Columbia, South Carolina. I think he came in and I didn't think he was expecting this, but I was like, Preston, get up there.
Yeah.
Do it during a live show, you know. So just so that he'd get the feel of it. Sure. And then secondly, we sat down for a long time and went kind of song by song.
Yeah.
You know, we probably didn't talk about the 400 songs that Panic has, but I bet you we talked about 100.
Yeah.
The ones that were in high rotation, I knew they'd play, or the big numbers, the audience favorites, and all that kind of stuff. And we made, you know, we had a Microsoft Word document that, that had them all listed, and it mm-hmm. had like a couple different columns of information, like, here's what I think the feel of the song is, here's what I, you know, here's the tempo, here's the type of song it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, he knew the big ones, but he might have not known all of them, all the things that he was going to hear. And then in the third column, there was specific lighting notes, like, you know, I use this cue, I use that cue, I use these colors, this person has a solo, there's mm-hmm. a dropout, or, you know, anything that would help him along.
Sure.
And then I'd say thirdly, I just have to trust his instincts.
Yeah.
You know, he's good at what he does, and he does things differently than I do. He comes up with different ideas than I do. When I go see his shows now, he's doing different stuff than I would have thought to do.
Yeah.
And you know, I like his style, and it was about trust, and it's like, you know, you're familiar with this type of music, you're familiar with this band,
yeah,
you're familiar with his show file, and you're familiar with lighting, so do the best you can do with it.
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's say instead of that scenario, let's say it's like you've got a young widespread fan who's trying to become a better LD. What general tips would you give to him to keep in mind when he's running a show? Not necessarily to be like you, but that are important for putting on a good show.
Just generically for any show or anything?
Yeah.
Definitely one of them is don't forget the purpose of lighting. And I do think this does happen.
Oh, yeah.
Lighting is there so that you can see the band members.
Mm-hmm.
The very first shows that were ever put on, and I mean, if you went to see the Beatles in 1964, if there was lighting there at all, it was so that you could see them
uh-huh.
and so that the fans could scream, you know. And that is the purpose of the LD, in my mind, is to make sure that that's happened. Now, obviously, today, we add almost a whole nother, we do add another creative element to the show. You know, in some of the more jam band circles, a light show is a big part of the show.
Yeah.
People go to see that sometimes as much as they do the music. I know I did.
Yeah.
But don't forget to light the band. Probably the second one, and I get the question a lot. A lot of people email me and ask me, or Facebook message me and ask me advice for a young LD coming up,
mm-hmm.
trying to find work or trying to find a band to work with. And my answer to that is just to do it as much as you can. And it doesn't matter whether you're doing it for free or you're doing it for your roommate's band, or it's something small, or it's something that you don't necessarily think is cool. Just get out there and do it, because it's only by starting to do it that more will come.
Absolutely.
You know, I don't like to see people wait on the sidelines and wait for somebody to ask them to try and do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, I'm not a console guy. I hear that a lot. I'm not a console guy, or it's above my pay grade, or my company hasn't sent me to training on this console, therefore I cannot become an LD.
Oh, I've heard that. I've heard that from house lighting people.
Right. You know? I mean, if I had waited for that, I would still be waiting.
Yeah.
So just get into it. Do it as much as you can. Learn as much as you can. Talk to other LDs. Just pretend that it's not a job. Pretend that it's a hobby or something you want to do. Pretend that it's a passion. It should be a passion. And do it as much as you can. I mean, if it's like going to church on Sunday and lighting the sermon, or, you know, anything, just get involved and do it. And work begets work, in my experience. And the more you do, the more will come to you.
Absolutely. I found, too, you know, like, I didn't start as a light guy. I started as a music fan, and then I was a DJ for a long time, and then a sound guy in the first. And I found as soon as I started to pay attention to light, it became important everywhere. You know, I like restaurants that have good lighting more.
Oh, yeah.
And I notice that now, you know. I mean, my whole family and the band give me a hard time.
Yeah,
they'll
drive your significant other crazy.
Yeah, but then at the same time, man, my apartment looks pretty good, you know.
Yeah.
It's got good lighting. So it's important everywhere. It's not just when you're working.
One of the best TV LDs out there is a gentleman named Bill Brennan, who I have done a load of work with on TV sporting events. And you cannot go anywhere with him. You can't sit at a bar and have a beer with him without him, you know, catching CNN on the background and commenting on how Anderson Cooper's nose has got a shadow on one side.
Yeah.
I mean, he always sees it. He sees things that I don't see. He sees things that I wouldn't see.
Yeah. The key light's not bright enough.
Right, and it's incredible to watch that. It drives you crazy sometimes.
Yeah, I'm that way with color temperature.
Yeah.
There are other LDs who, like, their front wash, the white is just 100% on every channel, and, like, I walk up like, dude, let's warm that up. You know?
Bill, who I just mentioned, actually color corrects his hotel rooms.
Really?
Yeah.
What, does he bring gels?
He has gels in his suitcase, and he literally color corrects every lamp in the room and an overhead if there is one.
I mean, you know, I laugh, but I've been in some hotel rooms where, like, the reason I hate it is because it's like a green fluorescent.
Because they have a 5,000K CFL bulb.
Yeah. Get that out of here, you know?
Yeah, not good for a hotel.
And then you walk into, like, a nice one, and, you know, that warm, it fades on.
Yeah.
And it's warm glow. You're like, ah, I'm going to bed.
Yeah.
We're further strolling across the street, junkies to a small red car. Mom's butterflies fly close like she's some Disney movie star. Saving hopes and lightning since Big Lee left us dry. Further, further, take to me, talk to me.
All right, well, I mean, not that we haven't already, but let's get nerdy, or nerdier.
All right.
Let's go through the Panic Tour rig. What fixtures are you using right now in the rig, and what video products are you using?
Let's start with the video, I guess, for a second. I've just changed to the Resulum video server, and that has really changed my world. I had the MAVPU before, which I'm sure is a wonderful product for corporate and that type of thing. It wasn't good for what I was trying to do with it. It wasn't good for punting. So,
and adding effects and whatnot.
No. So that's been a huge arrival for me. And then we just upgraded our screens at the beginning of this year. It's a Chauvet product. I can't remember the model number, but I think it's like a 5 mil or better.
Mm-hmm.
We had a 20 mil mesh for about 3 years prior to that. Mm-hmm. So that's not going to make a huge difference to you at the back of the arena.
Yeah.
But it's definitely going to make a difference to the people in the front row.
Sure. And photos. You get all those close-up.
Oh, absolutely.
Of somebody's head in the video walls, just dots. Yeah.
Yep. The photos would drive me crazy because it looks like the photo's in low res.
Yeah.
So then for lighting, the main, you know, my workhorse is the Viper at the moment.
Yeah.
I'm going to move to the BMFL.
Mm-hmm. So that's a Martin Viper profile?
Yes.
And then the Roby BMFL.
Right.
Which is a bright multifunction light, I believe.
If you believe what they tell you.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
That's what they say it stands for.
Yeah. We all think it stands for something else.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah.
We do. We know it.
Yeah.
We know it. And the Viper's been great. It's a little punchier than the VL3000 profile or spot that I replaced with it. I have problems with it. I can't get just the color system in the Viper continuously seems to be making the wrong color. I mean, the flags get dirty, and I don't get consistent color across all of them, which drives me bananas.
And are you a straight CMY color mixing guy, or are you using color wheel at all?
I don't use the color wheel a lot. I've sometimes thought that I should more.
Mm-hmm.
I'll use it for a deep saturated red or a deep saturated Congo.
Yeah, I would say sometimes, depending on the light, the Viper's not so bad, but green can be very muddy on some fixtures.
But, you know, almost all the time I have some sort of vague color effect running through.
Ah, okay.
You know, sometimes it's very noticeable and other times it's really subtle. And so even if I'm using a Congo, a lot of times it'll be the flag system. I have X4s. It's the bigger brother to the X4S that I had for several years prior to that.
So it's kind of like how you would have used a Mac 301 a couple years ago.
Yeah, or an Impression, if you remember those.
Yeah.
And I still have X4Ss on my towers, actually, but behind the band is kind of effect light.
Yeah, the beams get so tight when the zoom on those. It's great.
Yeah, they're nice. It's like having a zillion little Sharpies.
So are you using them upstage, the X4s?
Both.
Yeah, and so, are you knocking out patterns at all, or do you just leave the full lens intact?
Oh, no, I use the pixels, you mean?
No,
pixels, I use those.
Yeah.
Have a few dance effects with the pixels, pin spot effects, just using the center cell. And there is a little bit, I don't know if you've noticed this, I think there is a little bit of regression in the industry.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of, I mean, I feel like everyone rushed into LED, like guns blazing, and just threw away all their Mac 600s and bought, you know, RGB LED movers. En masse. And I think, I know with me, there's a little bit of trying to go backwards on some things. You know, there's some things, like if I'm doing something that involves a DVD shoot or a television, any sort of a video shoot, I really like to have discharge fixture.
Oh, yeah. You don't want to risk it.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. I don't think LED's quite there on that yet. Yeah. And on the movers, too, going back to GLP, their latest, you know, latest, greatest mover, they've taken a step back and gone back to discharge for it.
I mean, it still looks great.
Yeah.
There's no arguing with that.
Yep.
Yeah.
And people getting excited about tungsten again.
Yeah.
You know, we've had a lot of tungsten on a lot of the tours that we've provided. I didn't think I'd be buying dimmers at this point in time, but we've had some conventional tungsten again, and there's something about the way it behaves and the way that it looks and the warmth of it that just is not quite there yet with LED.
I mean, I feel like we're kind of entering in this era with lighting where nostalgia can be a real thing. Where, you know, just like with music, we've had enough versions of the technology. We're like, hey, man, I'm tired of the LED look. Like,
right.
Just, I mean, I know Nine Inch Nails did a whole tour.
Like vinyl.
Yeah, exactly.
Vinyl records, you know.
Yeah.
It's a very good analogy. I mean, the sound resolution of vinyl, everyone talks about the sound quality.
Yeah.
Everything that's come after it has just been attempting to match it.
Yeah.
And I think the same is, I mean, LED works hard to emulate tungsten. And the more it has to work to do that, it's like having a vinyl record. So anyway, back to your question about the fixtures. And then, you know, we have some tungsten on Panic. We have the Sun Strips, I call them. People have different names for them.
They look great.
Yeah.
Sun Strips are great.
Yeah. And this year I went back, you know, I had the 5x5 J-Rags out before. Gave them a rest for a while, brought them back this year. And again, you know, it's an MR-16, so MR-16, I think, or different.
No, I'm not sure.
MR-30 or something. And it's...
Are you using that like a mole, just like a bright audience blinder?
Yeah. And I still love the way that the dimming curve and the way it behaves. And
that's the other, I mean, I know you can kind of replicate it, but especially in the lower 10%, if you will, of the fader, LED does not, it just doesn't behave the same way.
No, it just kind of cuts off.
Yeah.
And, I know that a lot of people are trying to manufacture that little part of the curve in there, and I'm sure they will, you know.
Yeah, but just that beginning, even on an old, just like old park hands with a 8-channel DMX board, you can feel it's like the sun is getting brighter.
Right.
You
know? Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, let's talk about your show file. Is the Panic file a lot different than the Dead file? Like, did you build the Fare Thee Well file up from the ground for Candace?
Yes, the Fare Thee Well was done from scratch.
So it's safe to say that they're totally different files.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Very different.
Okay, so, well, maybe we can answer these questions for both, but specifically on your file, we already talked about punt versus sequences and cue stacks. What's the general layout? What do the X keys do? What do the faders do? What do you have on the screens?
Okay, well, my right-hand screen is mostly a programmer screen, so it'll have the preset pools.
Even during showtime,
yeah. It'll have the large groups up at the top, and then I'll have, you know, colors and gobos and beam and that type of stuff. And I do still weave in a little bit of programmer
operating. I think a lot of us do.
Yeah. My middle screen is largely executor soft buttons, and that's where I have a lot of color effects, a lot of the little stacks that I talked about earlier, the little specials that do things, a lot of things like back wall looks, you know, curtain looks, or specialized, you know, things for a certain song. Those will all be sort of assembled there.
Yeah. So it's basically just filled with action buttons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, from end to end. My left-hand screen... when I had the VPU, that was all video. That was all my clips and everything, because you actually had the thumbnails on the MA screen, which was great. And now that I've changed video service, it's got a little bit of video control stuff on it, and it's got some more action buttons.
Yeah.
So it's like an overflow screen for stuff. Then on the faders, starting from the left, I've got all my intensities for band members.
Those are far left.
Far left.
Oh, so like specials.
Key light.
Yeah, key light, yeah.
You're right. Then it'll get into some movement effects that I like to have on faders, so I can bring them in a little or a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I have all my speeds centralized. Every effect is tied to a Speedmaster. Mm-hmm. So have that's on the right hand end of the faders.
Now, cutting back to the movement effects, are you doing the same thing that Preston's doing, where that it's actually a sequence with different effects in the stack?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, yeah. Cool. It's not just one fader for one effect. You could make that do a variety
Right.
of
it could be a stack of 15.
Cool.
So if I want a circle,
yeah,
I might have a stack of 15 different types of circle
yeah.
or phases or you know, offsets or whatever. Yeah.
And then is one of the buttons like a pick which one and another button like go to the next one?
Yeah, so there'll be a, you know, skip to the next one. Mm-hmm. The fader will control on and off and the size,
yeah.
I guess. The speed will be on a different
Yeah, they're all linked to the fader, same speed.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then there's I use the load button.
Yeah, okay.
So one of them's a load, one's an off, and one's a load, I think.
Yeah, okay.
So the load will bring up a list so yeah. I can get a specific one if I want it.
Great way to do it.
And then I think I have that exactly duplicated for intensity stuff,
oh, okay.
which would be the like next set over.
Dimmer effects.
So I'll have, you know, a stack of dimmer effects for a certain fixture group on one fader, mm-hmm. but it might have 15 in it.
Okay.
You know, and sometimes it doesn't matter which one.
Yeah.
I just want one of them.
Yeah.
So I'll pull up the fader and sometimes just a little bit and it'll give me a little bit
of a
movement. It doesn't particularly matter whether it's left to right or random or top yeah. to bottom.
You know,
and other times I'll want a specific one.
Yeah.
So I'll go get the load.
So I noticed in Preston's show file, he has a warm stack and a cool stack for color looks for like the whole rig.
Right.
And that's something I would never do. But for him in this particular show that I was helping with, he's like, oh, I just want a new one. You know, and
yeah.
that could be the same kind of thing with the dimmer effect,
right?
Where some guys, you know, they want to know exactly what it is, but the reality is that the audience doesn't know whether you meant to go to like the left to right one or the random one,
right?
It's all about doing it in a musical way, I
right?
think.
Yeah, just to give you know, a lot of times you're just trying to introduce a little bit of texture or dynamic movement to an otherwise static effect
mm-hmm.
or a static look, and that can do that. It doesn't always matter which one I'm getting,
yeah.
as long as I'm getting one of them. And then I'll have another fader for another group, and then I'll have a fader that does both groups together.
Okay.
Or I could use the two independently together if I want one going this way and one coming that way
sure.
or whatever. And so there's that. Then I get into the intensity faders for the, you know, I'll have my spots, the washes, blah, blah, blah.
Now, are you in those are actual dimmer cues camp, or are they group master inhibitors?
They're dimmer cues.
Okay.
For a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
And then I'll usually have masters for them, not all, but I'll have masters a couple pages up.
Oh, okay.
So, for instance, if we're in a tiny theater, I'm going to want my blinders to top out a lot lower than if we're in a massive arena.
That makes sense.
So I can throttle back the maximum intensity of any light group. And also with LED washes, same
yeah.
thing. A couple pages up, and that's something I'll do in the middle, you know, before the show or
sure.
something, or yeah. maybe touch it up during the show. So they are dimmer cues. And the reasoning for that is so that I can have like momentary buttons over here that might include intensity on some things.
Yeah.
Right.
Swapping was the big thing that Greg Ellis was saying. He swaps all the time.
Right.
And which is blacking out most of the rig except for whatever that button is.
Correct.
And you can't do that with the group masters.
Correct. Yeah. Or if you want a strobe button that has intensity in it
yeah.
so that you can just bring in a sparkle
yeah.
Without those lights already being on.
Yeah.
You can't do that with a group master. Not, or at least not that I know.
Not that I know of either.
Right.
They're great for being masters though.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So is that all the faders?
Yeah. Pretty much. Then we get into the speeds and
sure.
Gobo rotation. All Gobo rotation is on one fader.
Yeah.
There's no Gobo rotation in any cue anywhere.
Uh-huh.
It's all...
And do they all spin the same way generally?
No. I usually have them alternated.
Yeah, okay.
But, and then if I want to actually control that speed of rotation in a cue, I'll write a macro.
Oh, just to change the fader.
Gobo rotation fader at 10.
Yeah, that's how I do it.
Yeah.
You know, you yeah. get...
The thing about punting a lot is when you want a specific cue,
yeah,
it screws up a lot of your punting cues.
Absolutely.
Right.
I have the same problem with prism rotation.
Yeah.
If you like, oh, I want the prism to come on in this cue, but I have a whole system for turning prism on and off on my punt side. So
right.
I do the same thing. I just have a macro line that turns the regular
yeah,
one.
My macros put my faders where I want them.
Yeah. It's a great way to do
pretty
it.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. So what about the buttons below the faders?
So those will usually be like momentaries for groups of fixtures. Like uh-huh. I'll have evens and odds on various things. If I'm wanting to get percussive with a song, example in the Panic world would be Sell, 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 you know, very percussive song. And I want to be able to actually run it like an old school light board, you know, like groups and stuff.
So buttons,
that's what it is. Submaster groups, I guess.
Yeah.
And other odds and ends of things, but you know, if you color wipes left to right, you know, like not an effect, but something that just wipes across the rig. Over on the left side, underneath the faders for each band member, those buttons would be cues that highlight that band member from the back.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if Jimmy's doing an emotive solo in the middle of "Let's Get This Show on the Road," I'm not going to have a key light blasting on him. I might have a, you know,
it's such a theater thing. I appreciate that so much.
Yeah. Like three or four coming from the back and doing him in a very, I guess that's the Brickman coming out again too.
Yeah. Oh, totally.
He does a lot of that.
You just pull three spots from the rig and yeah, that's great.
Random ones. Weird places, you know, and I've been trying to do more of that, and I actually need more places to put those.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. I love that look, especially, you know, in some, like you said, some really shredding deep solo.
Right.
Just bringing one bright light out at the back.
Yeah.
You know,
and then be able to change it. So have like those three fade out and have a random two come in.
Yeah.
And that is what Brickman is doing now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I just saw David Gilmour at the Royal Albert Hall in London in September.
Yeah.
And I hadn't seen him. I hadn't seen anything Brickman had done for 10 years, which was the last David Gilmour tour.
So far.
And that's what he's doing a lot of. Yeah. It's a lot of, you know, the rig doesn't look like anything really.
Yeah.
I mean, it has a circle now, but the rest of it doesn't. And things coming in from random angles and random places you wouldn't expect. I mean, weird colors that you wouldn't expect, you know.
And that's just make great photos too.
Yeah.
That's the thing. A lot of guys, I mean, myself included, I'm very like thinking about the rig from my world, what it looks like. But you can't forget what it looks like to the photographer in the front row or to the guy on his iPhone five rows back to the right, you know?
Right.
I mean, those cool light, I love that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's an easy, not to go off on a branch there, that's an easy trap to fall into with beam fixtures.
Yeah.
I made this mistake one time. I guess the first year I had Sharpies. And I had them going in some sort of pattern, which looked to me like a big sunburst, and like the whole arena could see what I was seeing.
Yeah.
And then I saw on video that like that performance was videoed.
Yeah.
And I saw it later, and I had a little circle around me at front of house of Sharpies going around.
Yep.
And you got to realize that parallax error of looking at those fixtures is
you have to
zoom them out way wider than you think.
Yeah, especially at a distance that you're experiencing.
Right.
You know, like in a small theater or club, you kind of can see where the parameters are.
Right.
But if you're,
and it's very easy to fall into the trap of doing a light show for you.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And not realizing that from the side, it looks like a whole lot of lights pointed at you.
I've seen a lot of designers fall into that trap too.
I've fallen into it, and
we all do. I think,
you know, I walk around.
Yeah,
you know, I walk around, and I'll have somebody else trigger a few looks and make sure that I'm getting everyone involved.
I actually have a position, I hardly ever use it, but it's actually called selfish.
Yeah.
And I use it for, like, I've got this one photographer buddy of mine, Jordan August, if you're out there, hello, where if he's there, I build him this selfish look where they're all pointed at his tripod.
Right.
And then we do, like, a big aerial, you know, and it gives this great, you know, but it looks terrible for everybody else in the room.
Right.
It's like, why are the lights in the
Yeah, why are they pointed at him?
Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's I hope I didn't do that for too long before I realized it, but you can fall into that. And the Sharpie is really, when that class of fixture came out, that's when it really was pronounced.
Have you ever done a show like in the round where you knew from day one that you couldn't think like that?
Not that I can recall.
Yeah.
I've done them in the round. I've done theater plays in the round.
Yeah. But not like a big aerial beam show.
No, I haven't.
Like I didn't see it, but like the U2 tour, the 360 tour.
Right.
And I think Bassnecker did a show like that. I'd be curious to see, like, the design process for that has to be a lot of 3D and a lot of walking around and checking your positions.
Well, you know what does help a lot, actually, is the elementary stage view.
Oh, yeah.
You can take that encoder and turn it to the side.
Yeah.
You know, it's analog, but that is helpful a little bit.
Yeah.
You can look at it from the top. You can look at it from the nosebleed seat if you want to and get a sense if you're really just killing yourself or whether you're getting everyone involved.
I know, do you know Andy Cass?
Sure.
He's with String Cheese now.
Yeah.
I know when he does, like, especially at Red Rocks, you know, you've got that big, big, steep audience section, he actually loads in a file that he's built so that he can, in MA or in 3D, go up to the top and check his positions and stuff. I thought that's great advice.
He's a very smart man.
It's a lot of work, but
yeah,
it's, if you build them all for you, you're cutting out, especially, you know, I've seen a lot of arena shows where you're up in the balcony and I'm looking down and I can tell that the LD built all his positions with, like, he thinks they're big aerial looks and they don't even get above my eyes, you know?
Well, you do have to, I'm not as sophisticated as Andy Cass in that regard. I mean, I do refocus for Red Rocks.
Yeah.
There's almost no other venue that I can think of that has that quick, a grade of audience seating. You know, there's almost nothing that's at the stage level.
Yeah.
It goes up immediately and it goes up fast. So it's very a complete fast. Refocus.
Yeah.
You have to do it, but that would be me the night before out there with a glass of wine doing it instead of the digital way.
So do you make any different design choices at Red Rocks because of that?
Well, if
I'm like, when you're building the rig, I mean.
Not specifically for Red Rocks. If I was going there to do a one-off show and designing just for that venue, then yes, absolutely.
But you guys don't like maybe rake the trusses at a different angle?
No, not really.
Yeah.
No, not that, no.
I can imagine with the tour rig that being very tricky.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
But every venue, every night is a refocus. It should be.
Oh absolutely.
If you're recycling your aerial positions night after night after night without at least touching them up, then that's something that could be improved.
Yeah. I actually, all my movement effects now key off of, I have a room left and room right and up and down, and I touch those up every day. And then, you know, you turn that big circle effect on and it goes from the speakers to above the audience to below their eyes. It works great, you know?
Yeah, well, I do something similar. A lot of times we don't find ourselves on center.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No, that never happens. We're always on center.
You guys are always in center?
No.
Oh, I was going to say, I'm not on center tonight.
No. A lot of theaters were not on center. A lot of festivals were not on center. A lot of places were not on center. So the trick that I like to use is I'll take... You know, I talked before about my utility preset positions. Uh-huh. I'll take every fixture in the rig and zoom it down to the smallest that it'll do, iris or whatever, and find the farthest away point in the room that I can find that is on center, which might be the back doors of the theater.
Yeah.
It might be the exit sign at the top of the balcony. It might be a Coca-Cola sign at the back of a big arena.
Yeah.
Whatever's on center. The farther away it is, the better, because that's going to be more accurate.
Yeah.
And that'll be what I call, you know, center reference.
Okay.
And then anything that's symmetrical that I do, we'll use that as its reference.
Oh, nice. So you're starting at that position and then adding.
Right.
Okay.
So that's the center of, say, a circle.
Yeah.
And your circle would be perfect. It'll be perfectly symmetrical, even if you're not on center.
Yeah, that's a great tip.
Or to build a static look, you know, if you're going through, and you're running through your positions with wings on, you know, so you're getting two lights mirrored from each other every time you hit next.
Yeah.
You can put them in that position if they're not symmetrical. They'll fly out there and then use the trackball to put them back where they belong and save it.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great tip.
If you're not on center, and that'll give you perfect symmetrical looks.
One we've been doing a lot this tour is the water bottle on a mic stand.
Mm-hmm.
We just put that in the middle of the stage, and then put every beam right dead on the top of the water bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a great position in and of itself.
Right.
But then you can grab them all and, like you said, move your trackball or fan or align it.
Yeah. Use the architecture of the room.
Yeah.
You know, if you have to count recessed lights in the audience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and put your things between them exactly, or find a, you know, also you want to park, especially with Sharpies, you want to park them someplace where they're not in somebody's eyes.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a lot of trouble with that I don't want them to always be in the same orientation, but when you're making that switch, you need to think about it. You know, I try to put a gobo in or
have them hit the balcony rail or have them hit above people's eyes or anywhere that's not where someone's going
to
be sitting.
And that's another thing too, where you're talking about earlier, I guess, being selfish with your positions. It's easy to be like, oh, well, they're never in my eyes. Like,
right.
But the reality is that half those positions, they're blasting somebody. You know?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I try to, people are going to get annoyed at hearing me say this, but I try to kill as few people as possible. That said, I'm sure I still kill lots of people, but I do work on not doing that.
Yeah. It's an important part. that you wouldn't think of.
And I think if you're the sort of person who's up at the very front and riding the rail, you're opening yourself up to getting killed more.
Yeah.
Than if you're someone who's sitting at the back.
You're in for the full.
So
yeah.
Yes, I probably abuse those people.
You're
worse.
Kind of a volume at 11 person anyway.
Right.
So you might as well have a Sharpie in the face.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so wrapping up from the buttons, what do you use your X keys for? Are they Showtime buttons? Are they more programming buttons?
No, they're Showtime buttons. Those are like all the momentaries. I have a lot of color bumps over there. I have lots of where my strobes would be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are you using the user one and user two sections at all to change those from executors to, say, macros or anything like that?
No, but I would like to.
Yeah.
That's something I need to dig into. I know that can be done, and I want to dig into that more because I could definitely use more real estate there.
Yeah, a lot of guys, including myself included, I have one of the screens is all aligns and matrix and groups. So you could, when you're not in the show, you just flip to that one and two pan wings, four pan wings, six pan wings. So it makes things faster.
Right.
But then again, I don't have touch screens, so.
Yeah, my little screen is all action buttons.
There you go, yeah.
And that's where I would have things like gobos.
Yeah.
Gobo rolls, spins, mm-hmm. zooms, focuses, irises.
Yeah, all that, the multi-touch screen.
Any of that whiz-bang stuff inside of light, all that stuff's kind of concentrated there.
Are you using layout views at all?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Great. One of my favorite things.
Great tool.
Yeah.
Are you using them the kind of new school way where you're building an interface on them, or are they just actually laying out like pictures of the rig?
I have pictures of the rig on there because I have not reached a level of being able to build interfaces.
Yeah, I don't.
If anyone out there would like to build interfaces for me, I will happily pay you to do so because there's some I would like.
Hit them up.
Yeah,
there's a bunch of guys who do. They do some crazy things with them.
I have seen incredible interfaces on those things. Yeah. I've seen European LDs come in and it looks like it doesn't look like an MA.
Yeah, they've got full. It's just three layout views.
Yeah.
And pictures of the gobos and stuff. It's a lot of work, but very very cool.
Yeah, I've seen someone who had a color wheel built.
Yeah.
Actually, circular and had the colors radiating out, so it was almost like a. Like a color picker, but it was with the layout view.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, they have the built-in, do I want to fade? How long do I fade? Oh, I want to wipe this in. Or they're very, very, it's basically just a million cues with macros and a layout view and then pictures for each one, but it's a lot of work.
I would like to be doing that.
Well, for any MA2 programmers out there, hit Paul up.
And the barrage starts.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about color. How are you, especially from when you're coloring the whole rig? What's your philosophy? What's your philosophy from a mood perspective and also from a control perspective? Do you have a whole page of color looks, or are you calling in one or two different colors every time you call up a color look?
I don't like to have too many colors going on at once. For a static look. Mm-hmm. I do have a couple color effects that are... I have them in a little column called Whimsical.
Mm-hmm.
Panic has a few songs that are whimsical.
Yeah.
A lot of them come from the keyboard player.
Yeah.
And so I have a lot of very colorful Mardi Gras or, circusy kind of feel for some of those, more New Orleans-y sounding songs. But generally, I like to stick to two or at most three. And if it's going to be three, then one of them is going to be a derivative of one of the other two.
Sure. So cyan and blue.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with a bit of magenta in it or something. Yeah. So you're not going to see me with colors that I think are clashing a whole lot.
Do you have any color combos that you absolutely just cringe when you see?
Yeah. Be hard pushed to say exactly what they are right now. Yellow screws me up a lot.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that yellow doesn't go with. Yellow needs to go with itself
mm-hmm.
in other and other flavors of yellow or limes or maybe a little bit of green or something. But if you put yellow with anything else, like yellow and blue,
yeah,
any blue with any yellow, I'm really tired of.
Yeah.
I have one interesting color in there, and we talked about pilgrims earlier, and I can't tell you why this is, but I have a color in there that is called pilgrims,
mm-hmm.
and it is only for pilgrims. Mm-hmm. It is not used at any other time, and pilgrims is 100% in that color. There is no other color in pilgrims.
Yeah. So, would you describe it?
It's a goldish, you know, it's yellow with a little bit more magenta.
It's like a maize, kind of, like corn.
Yeah, and not quite amber.
Yeah, okay.
Like a golden yellow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you mix that color?
Richer than corn.
Yeah.
Well, that would be like the McDonald's secret sauce or whatever.
Okay.
And it doesn't matter because no one would ever want it. I don't know the numbers, but...
Yeah, yeah. I like the secrets.
Yeah, I found it. I found it, and, you know, I've heard that song 100 times, and it lit it 100 times, and I've tried to do it in other colors, and nothing else works for me.
Yeah.
Nothing. No other color works for me on that song, and that color, I mean, I could use it elsewhere, but I don't. I like to respect it. I have no explanation for why that is. I've had it said to me that it correlates to a chakra point in the body, which
really?
Then also correlates to a note on the musical scale, which is somehow tied to the notes that comprise pilgrims.
I think that's beyond my pay grade.
Yeah, it sounds like something one of our fans would say.
Right? Yeah. Yeah. I get that, though. I mean, I can understand that. Yeah. I mean, for me, color is very, like, emotive in a lot of ways.
I guess what I'm saying is there's something subconscious about it.
Sure.
Can't tell you what it is, but there's something beneath my level of consciousness that is making me do that.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure after this comes out, people will maybe realize that, but have people noticed that before?
No.
So it's not something that some like, oh yeah, I know that, love that color you use in Pilgrims.
No, yeah. never heard that.
Well, get ready.
Yeah.
It's going to change now.
You've been listening to the podcast, haven't you?
Okay, let's talk about the touring rig with Widespread on a normal run, and maybe on a, oh, actually, no, I'm sorry. Let's back up. Can you maybe give us a more abridged version of what Candace's show file looks like? I know we already talked about the playback wing, but how is that different from yours? What did she have going on?
Let me try and remember.
Like, is she doing like this button is the whole rig or is everything punted? Does she have any stacks going?
A few, a small number. So for her, everything was on the left two screens and the left two banks of faders. She didn't want to mess with the right hand screen or the little screen or the X keys or anything. She wanted it all there, you know, the two banks of MA basically, and then the ETC to her left. So, and she didn't want to page at all. So she just wanted to play it like a piano,
mm-hmm.
you know, and which is how she does it. And yeah. That's how she's done it her whole career, I'm sure. And so that's how we built it. And then a lot of times it meant that if we created a new awesome color thing, that some other color thing would get fired
mm-hmm.
for its real estate on the screen. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
You mean, so by get fired, you mean like you got rid of it.
We got rid of it to make room for the new one because she only wanted to have, you know, 5 or 6 or however many. She didn't want to be overloaded with a ton of options.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it was a lot of action buttons on the left-hand two screens. I think pretty much everything was there. All the color effects, movement effects, and that type of thing. The faders were almost all intensity faders.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of fixtures in that rig, so I could see why that's necessary.
Well, they were used, you know, there were a lot, but they were also used in groups, just like we would. I mean, if you had 5, I can't remember how many there were, 5, 6, or 7 major groups of lights on that show.
Mm-hmm.
Just because there were 50 in one group, doesn't necessarily complicate the programming that much.
Yeah,
you know, that's one of the things that intimidates young LDs a little bit when they look at a big rig.
Yeah,
you know, it's still just X number of groups of lights. There's just more of them. You don't have to control them individually.
This is very true. I guess, like in my world, though, you know, like tonight I have 8 points. Like, I don't need 2 faders for that. I need 1. But when you have points out on the wings and you've got points, you know, you might want some separation there.
Right. Well, again, that ETC with all the handles on it came in very important for all that.
So can you explain from a technical perspective how the crossfade worked? So is it literally like she just had positions on faders on the ETC and the ETC itself would fade to another scene?
Correct, yeah. She would use the crossfade on the ETC.
Okay, so that wasn't a function in MA at all.
Not at all. Yeah. Of course, it's feeding to the MA.
Sure.
I mean, all of those faders are mapped to faders on the MA that are up on some higher page.
Yeah.
Right? So, say for argument's sake, there's 48, because I think there were.
Yeah.
Across. Those will be mapped to 48 on the MA.
Yeah.
And when you'd have a scene up on scene A of the ETC, it could be a combination of intensities and effects or zooms or speeds or any of that stuff all in a row.
Uh-huh.
And then she'd have a different setup, or she would then set up – that one would be running.
Yeah.
Then she'd set up a second one.
On the DMX controller set.
On the ETC, set up the scene B with whatever the next look is going to look like, which will be everything. Now, this isn't something I would have to really change my brain around a lot to be able to operate that way live, but that's how she's done it for years. So to her, that was very natural.
Yeah,
and very powerful, actually, because she wasn't just setting the groups that are going to be on or off. She was setting feels and looks and gobos and all this kind of thing. And then she could grab the crossfade faders and pull it down, and then everything would move, incrementally to its new state.
Yeah, that's great.
So not just the intensity's crossing over, but the effect might be crossing over.
Sure. So
or the zoom of the light or the speed of the movement or whatever would be crossing over with it. And actually, like I said, the reason we had that particular console is because the submasters could be switched to be a third scene. You have a C scene down there. So she could have one down here on C, which is like a go-to that she wants all the time.
Ah, okay, great. Yeah, you know? I mean, I've used old-school DMX boards. I totally get that. I just, instead of it being like, this is light 1, and this is light 12, and this is light 58, it's like, here's a movement effect, and a color effect, and a position.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, okay, makes sense.
Cool, huh?
Very cool,
If I could have a year to practice doing it that way, we could probably do some really cool stuff.
Did you guys, I'm guessing not, but did you mess around at all with having a visualizer for the new scene?
A preview?
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking from a technical viewpoint, you would have had to have done it differently, but.
Yeah, I mean, you could have done that, I guess.
But she kind of knew it well enough, so she knew what she was getting, more or less.
You would have had to get the console to put out the other scene on another port to do that. And I'm not sure it could do that.
But you guys didn't do that.
No, we didn't do it. No. We did have a different person, Chris Coyle, great guy, operating, handling a lot of key light particulars on that show.
Was he on headset?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he was talking to me. Candace didn't have a headset. So I had him up in the normal front of house position next to audio. We started there, but the way that the front of house structure was built, we couldn't see the whole rig from there. We were getting cut off by the roof on the front of house. Plus we were too close. Again, talking to go into what we were talking about earlier, we were just on top of it. We couldn't see what was happening behind us.
Huge rig.
Huge
stadium, man.
Enormous. And we were way too close for our needs. So Candace and I moved back to one of the delay towers, which put us off center.
I noticed that, actually, seeing you guys down there.
It put us off center, but the trade-off was worth it.
Well, I mean, did you maybe just go to center to focus?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then just move.
I could always go to front of house and do something on center. But to focus the rig, before the shows, the nights before the shows, I took a console to the back center of the arena, of the stadium.
Yeah.
With like a 300-foot DMX cable.
How was haze management for this event? Like how many foggers and hazers did you guys have?
There was no haze or smoke on that event at any time.
Really? It's just all organic?
In the event that anyone from the Grateful Dead organization is listening to this at any time, there was no smoke or fog of any type on that event at any time.
Fair enough. I mean, maybe some crowd created.
Pot smoke is great for moving lights.
How about video? How involved with that were you guys, and where did you get your content?
So there were two different video content firms present. There was one called Obscura, and the other one was Nocturne. They sort of handed it off to each other, and Candace worked with both of them on content.
Like, but she's not calling cues to them or vice versa during the show?
No, no, not during the show, not specifically. She gave them a lot of guidance at the beginning. She actually flew out to both different companies, I think, and spent, like, you know, a significant portion of time, like a week or more with each one, and got all the content that she wanted arranged. But that was an ongoing process right up until the end, because you remember that management brought in new things at the 11th hour, like the U.S. Blues Empire State Building thing, and the bit at the end, you know, the sort of the retrospective at the end, and all that kind of stuff. That was stuff was all done at the 11th hour.
Yeah,
some of it was no warning. We didn't know that U.S. Blues thing existed until an hour before it was supposed to happen. So, she really worked with all of them independently and gave them sort of broad strokes on what she'd like to see. What sort of ways she'd like to see the video used. Didn't want to see video all the time.
Yeah, I mean, that. If I had any complaint to the show, it would be like, there are a few moments where I just wanted to see you guys work.
Right.
You know, I mean, of course, as a lighting guy, that's, right. You know, and there's all this bright video washing out all the beams, you know,
right.
Especially with no haze.
Right.
So.
Yeah, well, that does happen a lot.
Yeah.
But we step all over laser guys in the same way.
It's true. It's true. Okay, time for the strobe round. Favorite color?
Congo.
Question you get asked the most at front of house?
Are all the lights pre-programmed?
Favorite venue to light?
Can I do an indoor and an outdoor?
Sure, yeah.
Indoors would be Radio City Music Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Love it. Outdoors, it's Red Rocks.
Yeah, it's an amazing place. I, a lot of guys have a hard time with the programming there. But if you get a night before,
very lucky in that regard.
Yeah, is that always? I mean, you guys have the record, so
yeah, I suppose 52.
I suppose they let you do whatever you want. You
know? Yeah, yeah, we're very lucky to get in there early.
Yeah. Favorite gobo?
Triple cone.
If you had to choose one color of the rainbow to never use again, what would it be?
Green.
Oh, wow, that's the opposite for me. Favorite Grateful Dead keyboard player?
Jeff Chimenti.
Favorite city or cities to visit on tour?
New York, Denver, and Milwaukee.
Favorite band or artist to listen to at the moment?
We'll just say Rush.
If you had a time machine that holds a semi's worth of modern gear, what concert would you travel back in time and light?
That's a good one. How about The Last Waltz?
Well, that's a great answer. Photographer who best captures your designs?
Josh Timmermans, and I'm with apologies to Andy Tennille, who is almost just as good.
Do you ever wander out into the parking lot scene?
Yes.
I guess favorite lot food?
Anything involving mac and cheese. Oh, no, you know, no, it's got to be grilled cheese sandwiches.
Grilled cheese sandwiches, yeah. Garlic grilled cheese or no?
Sure.
Yeah. If you had to build a light rig using only one fixture model, what would it be?
Maybe a BMFL.
Favorite color combination?
I like red and magenta and orange and magenta.
You're sick in bed and can't make the tour. Who do you pick to sub for you?
Preston Hoffman.
That's kind of a no-brainer. If you could light any one artist currently touring, who'd it be?
Tedeschi Trucks.
And then favorite cover to light?
Cover song?
Yeah.
Can't Find My Way Home.
Favorite post-show food? Maybe not lot food.
Philly cheesesteak.
Band member who would be best at lighting design?
Of Panic?
Let's say of Panic and of the Dead.
wow.
Well, let's say of Widespread Panic and of the Fare Thee Well cast, if you will.
Well, I'm handicapped by not knowing those guys that particularly well, but maybe John Bell.
Mm-hmm. And how about for the Fare Thee Well guys?
I don't know. We'll try Chimenti.
Okay. Last question. Do you think you can get Candace to do the podcast?
Yes.
Excellent news.
But you'd have to go to her.
Ooh, is she in Hawaii?
Yes.
I think I can make that happen.
Yeah.
Anything else?
I don't think so. We've covered it pretty good.
Yeah, we went pretty deep.
Yeah.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for being on the show. To learn more about Paul, visit concertlighting.com. It doesn't get any better than that.
It's easy to remember.
How long have you had that domain name?
About 12 years.
Yeah. Did you have to pay a lot to get it?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. You think it's been worth it?
Yeah, I think so.
It's concertlighting.com.
It's had a lot of comments.
Yeah, I mean, here I am, you know.
Yep.
I've said it twice already, so.
Right.
I'm Luke Stratton, and you've been listening to the Light Side Podcast. If you want to know more about me or the work I do with Dopapod, check out lukestrattondesigns.com. The Light Side is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Google Play. And contrary to popular belief, the intro is not from a nature show. It's actually my dad, Steve Stratton, who is a professional voiceover narrator. You can check him out over at strattonvoiceover.com. The intro music is a Dopapod song called Blast and is available for download over at dopapod.bandcamp.com. If you like the show, send me your comments, questions, or guest requests over on my Facebook page. Well, that's about it. See you guys next time.